Welcome to the On the Verge of podcast, where we explore the world of politics and policy and focus on how tech companies can navigate the politics of disruption. In today's episode, Senior Vice President Adam Benson sits down with veteran television journalist and former moderator of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd. Adam and Chuck discuss the changing media landscape, the challenge of AI and election misinformation, the future of journalism, and much, much more. Hope you enjoy, and don't forget to smash that subscribe button.
Welcome to the On the Verge of podcast. I'm Adam Benson. Journalism is often called the first draft of history. When it comes to political journalism over the last 30 years, few have had a bigger hand in writing that first draft than Chuck Todd. When he worked at the National Journal at the Hotline, he wrote the newsletter that I feel became the blueprint for Politico, Axios, and other publications we look to for political news today. Like many people in Washington, it was considered must-reading his first fact show at 11 a.m. Tim Russert saw Chuck as the future, which is a part of the reason why he brought him to NBC. His roles as NBC's political director and then moderator of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd reported on every story that mattered, but most notably, the rise of Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden. I'd been on the other side of Chuck's questions when I was the press secretary for Congressman John Dingell. He is tough, never overbearing, and always fair. I felt that if I could navigate a call with Chuck Todd, I was prepared to deal with any journalist that might come my way. We're pleased to have Chuck Todd joining us on the On the Verge podcast today. Thank you for your time and this busy political season, Chuck. Happy to have you.
Happy to do it, Adam.
It's great to talk to you again. So it's Trump versus Biden again. Mm-hmm. And we've seen these candidates. We know these candidates. They've been in the public eye for, 50 years. And we know them well. We've had political rematches, too, most recently in 1956, maybe before a few of our time, but it did happen. And we even had an ex-president try to get back into office. It was 1892. But in many ways, we've never seen anything quite like this race. And it's even different from what we saw in 2020 when these two battled the last time. What's your take right now on what we're seeing and what's going on?
Well, I think it really just depends on how you, like with anything, right? How you look at it and take it. If you're looking at American politics under a microscope and you're trying to figure out I'm looking for a virus. Where is it? Right. And there's, I think, multiple viruses that are impacting sort of where politics is headed. But it's, you know, this is what we had was a hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Donald Trump. And the question is whether this is sort of temporary, right? Or this is a permanent change, right? Is this Trump led or voter led? Right. And I think that's been a debate that I think we still don't have the answer to, right? Which came first, Trump or Trumpism, or the voters' demand for it, and he just sort of via paint by numbers stumbled into the messaging that they were looking for, right? I think it's something historians will continue to debate in 50 years, but you know, I guess the way I look at it is that we have a population that is being stuffed into two parties. And both parties are too big to represent the coalitions that they supposedly represent, right? And I think part of that is why we've had these, I think, a lot of intra-party tension, you know, the rise of the progressives on the left, the rise of the populists on the right, because I just think that these coalitions in many ways, because of the mix of cultural issues thrown into there, that we've created these sort of uncomfortable. The Republicans and Democrats, the Democratic coalition's a little more uniform, right? But not so much. I think the Republican coalition is fusing their cultural and populism and their economic populism together a little bit. So that's why I like to start sort of like that, right? Where we get so focused on the personalities. You know, this is still a reaction from the Great Recession, right? This is still, in many ways, Barack Obama and Donald Trump. One, due to the same forces. And I think that we just still haven't gotten this out of the system. Now, Trump got there because of those forces. He's remade the party in his image, which has now made him the establishment. And I guess the question really is now, does the Republican Party become something different after Trump or not? And oh, by the way, are we ever going to get to the post-Trump period inside the Republican Party? You know, that to me, that's as much of an unknown as anything. But this really is, you know, a result of the Great Recession and sort of the mishandling of it, both by Democrats and but more so by the establishment Chamber of Commerce wing Republicans who Trump is essentially blamed for everybody's economic problems.
That's really an interesting take, and the idea of Biden as a proxy for Obama and still kind of fighting those fights. It seems like that makes a lot of sense with the kind of rhetoric we've seen, but also tactics.
And Adam, you had a front row seat of this. I mean, Southeastern Michigan, right? That district, I know it really well. My cousin, my dad's sister and brother-in-law lived in Monroe, raised their family in Monroe. I've been visiting Monroe, Michigan since I was two. That everybody in Monroe buys their pop in Toledo so you can make the extra 10 cents. That's the one place where you can make the 10 cent bottle return in your favor. Buy your pop in Toledo right across the county line and then, you know, come back to Monroe. But that was Dingell country.
Yep.
And you saw this move. You tell me. There were different iterations of this. I guess NAFTA was the first iteration. What was the second iteration of this shift in Southeast Michigan?
I would say the auto bailout, that was a big part of it. And I think one of the things that happened,
even though it was successful, that's interesting. That was government protecting a state and protecting workers, ironically.
Yeah, but we felt that it wasn't really sold very. We saw, we were on the ground and we heard from voters that they didn't really give Obama and Democrats credit for anything that was done to make that successful.
Bin Laden's just dead, GM's alive. Remember when that the Biden slogan,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. It didn't stick. And I think that instead what we saw was a lot of folks get upset about government overreach. I remember there was a project in Ann Arbor, Rich, that needed work desperately. And we saw something of a backlash from voters who were like, why are you bringing up money for this bridge? Well, it's literally about to fall down. And it was in the shadow of Michigan Stadium, Chuck. It's not like a bridge that was out somewhere, you know, around the Palms. This was important to Ann Arbor commerce. And we got a lot of backlash. So I think there's this still there, and it's just something, like you said, the fever hasn't broken.
Yeah, I am, you know, it's funny. I really do look back at the Great Recession and the one basic decision. By the way, Josh Green has got a new book out, and I was interviewing him for it, so I read it, and it was basically the rise of the left, or the rise of the rebels. Rise of Warren, AOC, you know, he did the rise of like the Bannon wing and all that. And so this is kind of his point counterpoint. And it really threw me back into those days of the bailout, right? And how Geithner was thinking. And it was really fat. You just said how the auto bailout, people didn't sell it right. Well, it was the same thing with the bank bailout. You know, what is it? We only spent $38 billion out of the $700 billion. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the public knows. And it didn't matter that we did it. You know what we didn't do? We didn't save people from being foreclosed upon. And that was the Elizabeth Warren, you know, warning here. And think about what we did during COVID. Like the great lesson, I will say this, I give our politicians credit, left and right. Mm-hmm. They saw what we didn't do during the Great Recession, where we decided, hey, let's minimize how we help people. And they did. Like they was the bare minimum, and then we'll get out of this. Versus COVID, let's throw, there might be some corruption, but let's get the money out the door. God, I could remember hearing Rubio say it. I'm like, wow, Marco Rubio of 2010 never would have said that, right? But the Marco Rubio of 2020 is like, no. You're going to have some corruption, but we got to help good people. And I look, in some ways, the reason we don't, our COVID backlash, I would argue, has actually been quite minimum compared to the Great Recession backlash. And what's the big difference? Government shoveled money out the door for COVID and didn't during the Great Recession. The public revolted after the Great Recession because we got Donald Trump.
That is very true. And I, someday you and I will have to talk about my time with Paul Kaczorski on his campaign. And what
Kaczorski, the last working class Pennsylvania Democrat, right?
Yeah.
Not named
I was
Casey.
On the last winning campaign for Kaczorski. It was fun. We had some good times. But let's talk about some other things, like about this campaign. And I want to talk a little bit about technology and how I feel that technology has really been one of the big things that's changed campaigns. It's also changed us as people. And how do you think technology has changed the last 10, 20 years, the way Americans engage in politics?
This iPhone, right? This has changed everything. I mean, it's done a couple things. Number one, we've created a permanent political, I don't know what to call it. Is it a permanent political soap opera? But like we have a constant, it's almost like we've turned politics into an ongoing reality TV show where, you know, we have seamlessly moved. I would argue it started with Clinton's impeachment, right? Right. Cable news helped sort of condition the idea that there's always something. And then social media sort of almost thrives on the ability to create plot twists in our political soap opera, right? So I think we've, you know, I put it this way. I found the Ron DeSantis campaign was a victim of like living online. They didn't live in reality. He was a campaign that lived online for about 6 months and realized I have no traction. And then finally realized I need to get out for the internet, right? He was too online. And so I do think that we have, I always say there's sort of two Washingtons. There's sort of two American politics and two Washingtons. There's the one that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and AOC star in. It's online. Then there's the one that John Thune and Ron Wyden, you know, participated. They're the, you know, that like they just actually do stuff. You know, and it's a strange thing, right? It's essentially, it's the story Punchbowl covers is what I always say, right? Like it's there is this part of Washington that gets work done, but it's boring, I guess, right? I don't know.
The performance art is fascinating.
Right. What if I told you that there was a bipartisan tax deal that passed the Republican-controlled House Ways and Means Committee 40-3? The way we have advertised our politics on social media, something like that is impossible.
Yeah.
Right. But there is this sort of, right. So I do think what technology has done is created a distorted picture of American politics. And unfortunately, that distorted picture has had a huge impact on the real thing.
It's fascinating to me that one of the architects, Section 230, Ron Wyden, is painted. And he's always been a doer. But to think of him as sort of the contrarianist,
tech geek,
those that are dependent on technology, that's fascinating.
Boy, give me a couple of trial lawyers and I'll fix Instagram tomorrow.
You're on that. I'll see what I can do. I'll pull some strings.
Exactly. Obviously, we need to get rid of Section 230. But look, I mean, there's government regulation and then there's lawsuits. Sometimes lawsuits do better regulating than government.
And it doesn't feel like Section 230 is going to be changing anytime soon. But that's a topic for a whole other day.
You're right. Yeah.
I do think that what we are seeing, though, what social media and other platforms have opened up is this idea that somebody can campaign without going down the campaign trail. In 2020, they talked about Joe Biden campaigning from his basement. And now we're seeing the potential for Donald Trump to run a courthouse campaign of sorts. Social and various trials taking him off the trail, but still talking to the public about what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing this as becoming the new normal? And are we kind of?
I guess so, because I'll tell you this, Adam. I'd never felt such low energy in New Hampshire before than I did this time. Now, I felt the same low energy in Iowa, but I chalked that up to the weather. I mean, the high was -6 in the last week, right? So that's like, nobody should be campaigning in weather like that. But New Hampshire felt dead, but they had a huge turnout. Look, both primary turnouts were much bigger than I expected. So it is a reminder that digital engagement, you know, obviously the stuff you don't see, right? You and I are of a generation that you had to show your political ground game sometimes, not just orchestrate it, but the digital ground game clearly is now as effective, if not more so, than any yard sign you can put out or anything like that, or even door knocking, right? I don't know if you're just as better saturating text messages, where and it's cheaper than finding people to door knock and hoping they don't embarrass you, by the way, when you're door knocking, right? The thing that should scare all of us right now is AI right now, because we are in a period of no regulation. I do think everybody's engaged. I don't know. I've been tracking legislation in the state level. This is like it's the issue du jour and state, and everybody's introduced a bill, you know, some form right. of either AI disclosure or, you know, various forms of that, maybe a ban on AI if it's on certain things, or if you do it, you have to let people know up top. So we're in the middle of the no rule zone, right? It's sort of like the weed laws in DC, right? It's legal, but it's not, you know, it's like AI. It's like, it's open season for this campaign. And I've already seen some things. I don't want to bring too much attention to you on it, but we've been the victim of some AI parodies that some of the campaigns have created that we have tried to deal with on a little quieter, frankly, because if we start going, hey, that news report that you think is from us was an AI parody from, well, then if we're all complaining about it, eventually what the public's going to say, well, I don't know what to believe.
That's right. That's a real
thing. My concern about AI right now in a selfish way is that it will be used to abuse our already low standing with the public, and that whatever credibility we have left essentially is erased because the public isn't sure whether I'm really reporting it or AI Todd is reporting it, right?
And, you know,
and that's a scary place to be in the moment. And again, these campaigns are already doing it. This parody that they did, you know, it was a satirical thing. It was like eventually you would figure out it was a joke, but the AI audio the technology is there. It is there. No, we are going to we saw it with the Biden robocall, right? Like this stuff is going to happen.
Yeah. The voter just isn't as locked in on what's going on broadly as those of us who are working in it are. And when they see something
they're just going to throw up their hands.
Yeah, that's
right?
That's exactly.
And they'll just say, well, that's it. I guess I don't know what to believe anything.
I don't know what to believe. I can't do it. Yep.
Which may mean in person may matter again. Right? Like I'm like actually going in a roundabout way that it may actually go, oh, I'm so afraid of, you know. Remember how upset people were to find out when they call customer service and the person was somewhere in another country?
Okay.
You know, now people are going to get, am I talking to a human or a bot? Right?
Right.
And I think our politics could feel the same way.
I want to actually drill down on this a little further because I want to I want to talk about AI and I'm going to jump into a policy arena first. And it ties in with the campaign. But we have two men, let's just say they're from a previous generation. One of them is notorious for being a true technophobe but not being interested in using technology at all. Are these the guys that we can count on to regulate AI? And can they carry on a national dialogue about what needs to be done to protect us from Skynet?
I mean, I think you answered the question in the way you asked the question, right? Like, I mean, this is a huge problem. I mean, it's a giant problem in Congress. The people charged with regulating it don't quite understand it. I remember having a conversation with Tim Geithner about the financial, Sarbanes-Oxley back in the day. And he said, my biggest problem is Mark Warner and Bob Corker are the only guys that understand this. And he goes, I'm not trying to disparage other members of Congress. It's just like you've got to understand how securities work, you know, to type of thing, and both, you know, type of, to understand how to regulate this and all of it. And I think we have the same problem with AI. I mean, kudos to Don Beyer, right? The congressman that decided to go get a graduate degree and like, hey, I think I need to know this. Not everybody's Don Beyer, right? That's a very to me, a very responsible thing for a public servant to do. I've got to regulate this. I better go learn it. And we certainly have a few people in Congress that are smarter than the average bear now. You know, your Ted Lieu, who was a coder and things like that. So there is some there, but it's not just the two presidential candidates. You know, I'm concerned about the entire political infrastructure that kind of just doesn't get it. You know, it doesn't fully understand what they need to be advocating for on the regulatory department. I mean, I don't even think we're structured correctly in dealing with, you know, we don't regulate algorithms yet.
Yeah,
we should be. I mean, I think we already have the institution to do it. It's the FTC. But that takes people to get aggressive here to sort of make it their jurisdiction. So I think that also is a challenge.
Well, you bring up an interesting question about who's watching this, because think about who's watching cybersecurity. It's the judiciary, right, in the House. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my old boss would say his jurisdiction was the world. But there isn't really a committee that's dedicated.
Well, wasn't he chair of commerce?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Energy
and
commerce.
That, by the way, energy and commerce, they do. I believe their jurisdiction was, what's your jurisdiction? When John McCain, everything, right? When Fritz Holling's at it, everything. Like,
that's
and
right.
It's true. Energy and commerce. I mean, what isn't commerce?
What isn't commerce?
Right?
He did, and he worked that pretty effectively. But I do think that it is an interesting question about Washington, and I think about the Hill. Is the Hill set up to regulate and really monitor and watch this? And I just don't know if House members on the judiciary side are really focused on cybersecurity.
They're not. And you know how and here's my beef with how the Judiciary Committee is where every leadership team, Democrat or Republican, puts all of their nimrods. Okay. You know what I mean? All of the partisan either hacks some of them are true legal beagles, right? They just love the law and they really want to be it. But you always have, judiciary is usually, because it's not a fundraising committee, right? So anybody that cares about fundraising wants to be on energy and commerce or ways and means or appropriations, et cetera, right? So the ones that want to be on judiciary are sort of the legal nuts or the legal experts. And then you also have the partisan activists who the Judiciary Committee is made up of what I would say are the least effective members of Congress.
That's a good one, Chuck. I'm gonna pivot from that.
I know you are. You don't want to. You got too many friends on that committee. I get it. But it really frustrates me how we let that committee get so – it's polarized on purpose. And it's because both parties treat it like an activist dumping ground, and it's not healthy.
It's one heck of a hot take on your part. That I will give you.
Thank you.
That is,
all
that
right.
Is
fair good. Enough. Yes.
Turning back to AI for just a moment, because we talked a little bit about how the candidates are using AI and how they're thinking about how they can be used effectively to reach us. What about your team in the media, the folks you're working with, and how you're using AI, or if not using it, watching it? And you touched a little bit on this, but what kinds of things are you doing in the AI arena that's changing your job from where it was previously?
It's interesting. We haven't yet. Okay. I'm not saying that we're not using some tools that the company's giving us that has some AI, you know, impact. But look, I've been looking for ways to see if it can help us do what we do. And there's nothing, you know, other than, look, is it, you know, when it comes to transcription, interviews, things like this, the automated, what you want to call that, AI, I don't know. You know, there's certainly those type of tools that have been very helpful to us. But I've been looking for ways. Is there better ways for me to cover campaign finance, for instance? I would love is there an AI assist on this? I haven't found anything yet that's helpful. I also could be this could be above my technological pay grade. Maybe I need to find somebody to write something that would help me type of. But we are not at that stage yet.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. You are thinking about it, though, I'm sure, with social. And I know this is something you paid a lot of attention to.
Well, I'd love to figure. I'll tell you this. This is here's my frustration. I go back to my old hotline days. You brought it up at the beginning.
Yeah.
And our mantra back then used to be cover the coverage. But what the idea was is that, hey, we were an alert service, right? We were letting you know, hey, this is popping over here. Better be careful. This could go national, right? It was almost like I always said we were kind of like a little bit of a political intelligence service, trying to spot a trend before it took off, right, type of thing. And so as a political reporter, I'd like to know what's going on TikTok. The problem is, if I monitor TikTok with my algorithm, I'm not going to see what a voter's saying. Do I create fake profiles so I can get a follow? I can create a MAGA algorithm. I can create a progressive algorithm. I can create a centrist algorithm. I can create a celebrity algorithm. You see where I'm going here, right? But I'm also uncomfortable as a journalist using fake profiles to monitor social media. I'm ethically uncomfortable with that. But I also feel as if I'm lacking in, well, what the hell is circulating on YouTube, right? When it all depends on your algorithm, depending on what you're seeing, it is harder for me as a professional to monitor what the public is seeing. So I have really been, it's a black hole for me. And I always want to know what's happening, what's gone viral, what's doing this. And I just think if I were sitting at Hotline today, I probably would be trying to figure out, well, let's see if we can create avatars, right? Little, voter avatars based on, community profiles, based on demographics, all these, come up with the various voting groups that I want to monitor. But that is a very difficult process, right? We haven't figured out how to regulate algorithms, let alone how to cut through them, right? So that you don't get locked out of something because of an algorithm.
But you really are touching on something that is one of the most fascinating dynamics in campaigns today, which is that there's no central hub anymore for information. And your perspective is completely based on who you're talking to and what kind of things you're following. There's just, and I would think for what you and what you're doing to boil through that and get a real clear picture of what's going on.
Look, I always say I'm stuck covering the politics as it is, not as I wish it were, right? That's the position I have. Other people can do their jobs with a point of view if they want to, that's fine. That's not my job. My job is to explain what's going on and why it's happening as best as I can from an observational point of view, not necessarily a neutral point of view, but from a sort of an expert observational point of view. And it's really hard to know what voters are seeing and what they're talking about. I mean, it really is. We have become so tribal in our information ecosystems that it is really difficult to break through. So look, I think this is a great challenge for us in big media. And I'm struggling with, I don't know whether legacy media can reform itself or whether we should try to start something else. Yeah, think of it in a different way. Look, CNN came out, was a brand new thing when cable TV came on our things. Should we be thinking about this in a different way now that now that linear television and cable TV are sort of are on the back nine of existence? And I'm also not sure the for-profit model and honest journalism can go together. And I hate coming to that conclusion. But I'm struggling to see how you can be, because I can never, how am I going to get somebody to pay for Gaza coverage? Right? And if I have a corporate entity wants you to be cost efficient in covering the news that's necessary, how often are we going to be on the ground in war zones?
This is a great question. And I what you're bringing up is something that I think about a lot. I consider how to cover misinformation and disinformation a lot. For a national outlet, whether it's NBC or the New York Times or whatever else, to really get into the place where a lot of this misinformation and disinformation is taking hold, you got to go you got to go hyper-local. How is an organization wired to capture what the country is feeling, able to really dig in on what's happening at Poughkeepsie or Peoria or wherever else?
Well, we need some third-party verifiers. Like, I've been obsessed with we need a Consumer Reports for social media. And I know some people over there, and I've actually pitched the thought, like, I think they don't, they're not ready to get into the news and information business. And I understand why. Here's an entity, a nonprofit that has got a gold level of trust with the public, right? I mean, just terrific. So that's why I look at them and I'm like, what can be emulated from them? What can we learn from them to create a trust vehicle, right? They are the most trusted place to find out if a product's legit or not, right? Okay. They own that space, and they've owned it for 100 years. And they've never deviated. They've never sold themselves out. They don't take advertising, right? They're very – and is there a lesson learned there? Imagine if we could come up with a trust entity. I don't think we can ever vet every social media post. But I would like to know whether a social media poster, okay, an account on TikTok, account on YouTube, whether they have passed, whether they are – get the news consumer report seal of approval that their posts are based in fact. Whatever it is, they don't traffic in 85. They don't traffic in misinformation. They're we're not saying everything they say is 100% true. Just like Consumer Reports doesn't say this is the best product to buy. They just tell you these six products do what they say they do. We think the best price is here. And I don't know what that looks like, but I feel like at a minimum, we should be able to figure out how to verify a social media account as a good place, good nutrition, bad nutrition, right? Mm-hmm. Mindset.
This is going to be very tricky. And I bring up something that happened on the trail. Nikki Haley made a suggestion at one point. It was kind of a story for her. Maybe 36 hours in the Iowa cycle, where she brought up the idea of having people on social media actually use their names, that nobody could hide behind an avatar or an identity. Mm-hmm. And she got so much blowback from her own part. And they actually have a very legitimate point. I mean, we have a history of people using aliases. Alexander Hamilton to start with.
Yeah.
So others throughout time have used aliases. But
Ben Franklin.
it's part of our history to be able to do that. Right. But at the same time, right now, I don't think any of them ever saw a place where we really wouldn't know where our facts are coming from and who created these facts. And that reminds me, your great moment many years ago talking to Kellyanne Conway when the alternative facts line took off it became part of our political that.
And it also turned into a foreshadow.
Yeah, it did. So. And to a point now where we really have the old two Americas line, we really have two Americas right now. It's just split now along who believes what facts.
Two realities.
Yeah. I like that. Two realities. I'm going to go with that and use that instead. I'm stealing it from each other. But people seem to believe what they want to believe or what their tribe tells them is okay to believe. And we now increasingly have a dedicated industry working on social media built to serve up these facts to both wings of the electorate. Have those spreading misinformation, disinformation, have they already won the day?
I feel overwhelmed at times when I'm like, look, I've decided this is where I'm throwing my energy, is trying to tackle the trust issue. And, I don't know whether it means starting something new. I don't know whether it means there's there's a niche trust thing that can be created. I know I'm more in the, we've got to do better. We've got to try. And I'm tired of small ball. You know, what we don't need is another ProPublica. I love ProPublica. What we really need is all of these entities to start working together. You know, something that sort of like take our journalism back. You know, take our, you know, I call it private BBC in some ways. I don't want government involved, but I think we need something, a public trust, you know, if you will, a public news trust of some sort. And there should be for-profit competitors. Don't get me wrong. You know, so I don't want one, you know, but I think you want to almost have this, you know, another big attempt to try to, you know, break through this a little bit. So
I think you'll find the biggest supporters of what you're doing are actually the billionaires who built the industry of social media. Craig Newmark, for example, has put a ton of money into this.
I spent a little bit of time with him. I mean, right. You know, I love Craig, and there's no doubt in my mind, had he known in advance that Craigslist was going to destroy local journalism, he'd have at least come up with a better way of trying to do it, right? You know, I don't think he deserves blame for it. Creative destruction, you know, if he didn't do it, somebody else would have.
That's right.
I actually look at the old way that newspapers were funded, and it turned out, by the way, to me, people took the wrong lessons away from what happened to local news. The newspaper was a brilliant business model, right? Which was a revenue stream over here to support, you know, nobody ever subscribed to the newspaper for the A section. It turned out they were subscribing to the newspaper for every other section. Some people needed the one ads. Some people needed the, you know, wanted the puzzles. Maybe you had movie listings. You know, it was a utility in your life. Nobody loved the newspaper, but it was like, well, you know, I need to sign up. I need a phone. I need newspaper. I need, you know, electricity, right? Like it was a utility. So I do think my North Star when it comes to a building something new, if this is indeed the path that I think we should go down, is the first order of business should be a good news organization is a utility in your life. It's not something you can't wait for. It's actually something, though, that you need. So a news organization needs to be better at being a consumer protector, a protector of consumer rights, right? I don't think news organizations do enough consumer. You know, I always look at why does local news win the trust, win, get the highest level of trust? Because local news tells you whether to wear a coat or not. And local news, like, well, sometimes, hey, be careful. Somebody's going door to door to try to sell you X, right? And we used to sort of make fun of that style of news. It's like, no, you're helping people live their life. And, you know, so I think that the lesson we need to take away from the destruction of newspaper is don't try to get people to pay for the news. Try to get people to pay for other stuff to help fund the news. So maybe it is puzzles. Maybe it is recipes. Maybe it is college football recruiting, right? Maybe it is Green Bay.
I always football recruiting.
Right. The Green Bay Press Gazette charges for their sports coverage. Why do you think that is? Right? Like, of course they do. And they should. The Miami Herald charges separately for their Miami Hurricanes football coverage, as they should, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the way to do it. But I don't think the A section should ever be behind a paywall. Right. None of the all the news stuff shouldn't be behind a paywall. So I do wish we would sort of unpack what made newspapers work and really understand why they worked and why the public sort of accepted it, because we were providing more than just news. Right. The newspaper was helping you live your life. A good news or a trusted news organization should be there. Look. I in my fantasy news organization, I'll have webinars on how to start a business on Etsy. How do you sell on eBay without, you know, people will pay for those things because it helps them with a side hustle, right? I think we have to get creative and coming, because billionaires have been funding news organizations since the start of news organizations, right? This is not a new, William Randolph Hearst didn't make money off of Time, right? Like, he just decided he wanted to be, you know, Every billionaire at some point decides they want to own a media outlet, it seems, right?
That or a rocket ship these days.
Right. Or both. but so I'm not, but I also think we shouldn't be afraid of finding alternative revenue streams. But I would be careful charging for the news, because if you do, then you search for audiences, and then your news is shaped. The news coverage you have is shaped by the audience.
Yeah.
That subscribes. And I think that's a dangerous place to go.
You're talking about how Craig Newmark has generously given away some of his fortune to finance things that society could use. Mm-hmm. He's given a lot of money to journalism, but he's also given a lot of money to cybersecurity. And that's been a big passion play of his. There are a lot of people very concerned about cybersecurity, but it seems like increasingly it's getting the short shift of public dialogue, public conversation. President Biden didn't talk about his last State of the Union. President Trump hasn't spoken about it too much, certainly not on the trail. And even the media, recently the Washington Post killed its Cybersecurity 202 newsletter. It's must reading for those of us who care about cybersecurity.
Right.
Why is it so hard both for candidates to talk about cybersecurity, but also the media to really have a conversation about cybersecurity?
Well, I think it needs to not be talked about as cybersecurity. It needs to be talked about as protecting your finances. It needs to be talked about as protecting your privacy. You talk about it as privacy and people will perk up. Excuse me. The second you use the word cyber and security, I think eyes glaze over. Sounds like you got to call the IT guy. Right. I think this is a simple messaging thing. I think I believe if you're looking, you know, when do people engage in cybersecurity? When they feel as if, oh my God, people can listen in on my thermostat. What is Alexa doing? Right. That's all obviously falls under cybersecurity, but I do think that there's certain words sometimes, and I know that sounds, I'm being a little simplistic, but I think it's campaign finance reform is another one, right? Money in politics. It's hard to get people. It's so ubiquitous that it's too much to think about, right? And so I think in some ways it's how the issue is presented. And I think if you want people engaged on it, look, Washington can call it cybersecurity, but when you're talking to the public, it's about protecting your privacy.
Yeah.
Protecting you, your, and I think we all know when it's through the prism of privacy, people pay attention.
We talked a lot about journalism here, and I want to drill down on it a little bit more, because as we speak, we're in a period of layoffs and really discouraging news. The Los Angeles Times had a big round of layoffs recently at the time, just around the time we're recording this. Sports Illustrated was not that long ago. There's Condé Nast, Time, and the list goes on and on, as well as the buyouts at the Post. What does the state of journalism look like right now? You in the trenches and someone making news. What do people feel like in these jobs about what's going on now in journalism?
Well, look, I mean, this is the I struggle. There's no greater set of resources that a news organization can have than Comcast as an owner of NBC News. It's ditto for Disney and ABC and Paramount and CBS. And in some ways, we have and Warner Brothers and CNN. Right? We have these vast. I can at a moment's notice, we can spend $10,000 to get somebody. You know, we have that ability to spend stupid money sometimes. And I don't mean it stupid, like just stupid costs. Like, I can't believe it costs that much to bring people to the front lines of a war in Ukraine or the front lines of a war in Gaza. But look, I will tell you where I'm not speaking for NBC, so my PR people can know this, and my bosses, and I say this with no disrespect to my bosses either. Okay, I respect business decisions. I understand how it works. I am wondering whether journalism can fall under this, right? So, but I believe the worst thing to happen to corporate-owned media companies was the O.J. Simpson trial. And I go back, I think that was our sort of moment, the worst moment, what put us on this road. Because what the O.J. Simpson trial was an example of was news organizations making money off the news. Now, it wasn't important news. It was never important news. It was salacious. It was fascinating. It was jaw-dropping. Because we all knew OJ. It was a celebrity story. So it was certainly a water cooler story. Our coverage of it turned it into a story that seemed important because it was it's an important story in the history of the city of Los Angeles and its issues with race, particularly the LAPD. So I am not trying to minimize that part of the OJ story. But that is not why news organizations covered it, right? It's not why people watched it, right? Okay. It was a whodunit, right? It was an interesting whodunit with a celebrity and all this stuff. It was a reality TV show that news organizations covered. But here was what happened. The news made money. So how did that condition media executives who were not journalists first? And again, they answer to another authority, right? A business authority. But it conditioned media executives that news divisions can make money if they choose to, if they cover news that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I would argue we became a narrative driven, that what happened was sort of it ends up happening semi-organically, right? If you can get numbers, you can get resources, right? And by the way, numbers isn't just TV ratings, it's also clicks.
Right.
In some ways, I would argue digital media is more ratings driven than television media now, you know, because of how important traffic is. Like, I think the worst invention in the world was the most emailed story. Just a terrible idea. Look at the New York Times op-ed section. I think it's the most groupthink op-ed section. And when James Bennett ran it, it was not. But I think the worst thing to happen was the most emailed or most read among opinion in the opinion section. All that does is condition opinion writers to write to what's being read, right? Like, just it's a constant reminder of right to the traffic. I hear it in our own budget, you know, our own sort of managing, you know, news budget meetings. Hey, this is getting a lot of attention, so we're going to do a follow-up story today. Well, is there news? Well, the public's interested, right? So when did this change? For me, that line of demarcation was O.J. Simpson.
It's fascinating, right? You said. Yeah.
And I wish we could have that moment back, because before then, news divisions weren't expected to make money. They just were asked to not lose money. And I just think now, you know, so more and more, there was a belief that and to me, you can't always count on the news making money. What is the compact, if you will, that you made with the public, right? And I'm old enough to remember when our CEOs, whether it was at GE, and even now, they'd say, oh, no, NBC News is a crown jewel. And I've heard Iger use the same thing about ABC News. They're not funding the jewels, you know, because part of it is they don't want the controversy, right? So now there's all this other parts of it. They don't want the blowback. All of the streamers want out of news. It's not that they don't like us. They just decided, it's a business headache. My board gets mad. Let's let somebody else have this headache. I want to get out of it. And so, again, I understand how this has all happened, but it has me second guessing whether corporate ownership is and good journalism can go hand in hand.
The transformative nature of the Simpson trial is something that we don't talk about enough as a society. I mean, when you and I were younger, what did you have on in the afternoon yet? Soap operas. I could tell you the Simpson trial killed not just soap operas, but afternoon TV as we know it. I worked at a CBS affiliate that during the Simpson trial switched. It was a New World station. It became a Fox affiliate. And all of a sudden, there were 3-4 hours in the afternoon, nothing to show. Well, the Simpson trial was the gift from the heavens for those stations. And they showed it, and people watched. They stuck around for the news, and it changed. It really transformed afternoon TV.
Adam, before OJ, I would argue we weren't so narrative driven. But think about it. We went literally from OJ to Monica to the 2000 election to 9/11 to the Iraq War to the financial – shoot, I'll throw in Terri Schiavo in there, which was – talk about a manufacturing. Terri Schiavo, a story that never would have become national news, pre-OJ, but because we needed a new reality show that week, I mean, it is, you know, I give you the plane, missing plane, the poop cruise, right? You just go on and on that OJ was started it all. I mean, if you don't like the Kardashians, you get to blame OJ. And if you don't like cable news, you can blame OJ.
We had, for the Schiavo case, we had a national reporter who was going to come out to Ann Arbor and cover a Social Security event, a town hall, and talk about what was happening with Social Security and the effort to privatize it. And I got an email from him the day before. He'll remain nameless, but a great guy, well-known journalist, who said, I want to come. I'd love to be there, but I got to cover the Schiavo. I can't go out to Ann Arbor and talk to real folks about this because the Schiavo thing's just sucking up all the energy. I want to get into a lightning round with you. Ask
a quick question. Okay, because I got a lightning round amount of time.
Will we have a debate to retort by this race?
I'll be shocked if we do. I doubt it. I think it'll be a fall campaign of a lot of moderated town halls.
Will the candidates spend more on social media than on television?
No. TV is, you know, too many voters over 65 in both parties, whether it's older voters of color or older MAGA voters, they watch a lot of linear television.
What social media platform is the platform for candidates right now? I guess it's TikTok, but what's your take on it?
Well, it's sort of TikTok, but look, I won't go on it. I won't put my phone on it. I'm uncomfortable with it. I know my kids do and all of that. So, you know, but I'm also worried about a blind spot with TikTok. And I'm determined to figure out a better way to monitor what's going on TikTok without feeling as if I get to contribute to China's algorithm.
I get that. Okay, you touched on a little bit of this, but I'm going to drill down a little further. If you were 20 years younger and you got into political journalism today, looking to figure out the best way to cover this election, what would you do?
I'll tell you this. I would probably want to be embedded in like a Maricopa County. You know, I might want to almost stay in one area, one state, and get to know and basically find all the swing voters and just do it there, because you know that this whole thing's going to come down to a small slice of voters. So I would want to be, and I would do this carefully. And it's the way we designed our county to county project a few years back. They're doing it slightly different this time. I don't have as many fingerprints on it. But I'd want to be in a big Trump county to understand the conversation that was had there. I think trying to infiltrate sounds like a devious word, but that's really what it is. I'd want to infiltrate as many new bubbles as I could. So I'd want to be in a MAGA bubble for a week. I'd want to be able to go into different bubbles. So I'd probably be monitoring it by county. Whether I could do it out of one state, you go to Wisconsin and you could go to Dane County for one conversation. You could go to Milwaukee County for one conversation. I could go up to Green Bay and Brown County for another, right? I could do the same thing in Michigan, but I would probably pick one of the battleground states and then try to go into the different tribes, tribal towns.
It's never too soon to start talking about college football. And you and I both have our U of M's that we love, right? So what's going to happen next year? I'm still enjoying this year, by the way. I haven't stopped.
I was just going to say, it's the year of Michigan. Are you a Lions fan too?
Kind of. I'm one of
Nobody's ever a Lions. Fans. Poor Lions. People just gave up on them. It's like being a Wizards fan here in D.C. It's like nobody. My son ended up a Suns fan, and we love NBA. And I'm still a Heat fan, but I want to be a Wizards fan. We're all in on the Nats. They made an effort. Yeah. But sometimes a team is bad for so long, they'll never get the populace back. Is that what's happening with Lions?
I know. I think a lot of other people stuck around. I feel a little guilty. I'm revising history in my own world a little bit. I gave up on the Lions. I cast them aside. There's a little bit of guilt on my part, feeling like I'm jumping on that bandwagon. I never did that. With the Tigers, Pistons, and Red Wings, I've always been there. The Lions, I feel like I can't totally claim them and just go. I have this theory.
I had this idea. If Lions don't get to the Super Bowl, I think they ought to create a curse.
Rare.
Meaning that there's a curse. And I want to call it the George Plimpton curse. that they, that the whole, and if anybody, you really have to be a deep, this is going, this is like a deep cut, right? But there's a, the whole idea that he went into mock, you can't mock football. Paper Lion mocks football. George Plimpton, this Ivy League stick in the mud, mocks how football works, although he ended up falling and he realized that it was a more of a thinking man's game than he thought. But that is the curse. The Lions allowed him to fool them in training camp. Right. So there has to be some sort of curse of George Plimpton.
I like that. I'll go with that. But let's see what happens. Maybe they'll put the curse of George Plimpton to bed before it ever starts.
Yeah. It would be a lot of fun. No, they're getting America's team. Look, you tell me, Jim Harbaugh, do you want him back or not?
I'm ready for Jim Harbaugh to go. As much as I love
him. Boy, every Michigan fan I know in my life has said that. He can go. And in fact, I sense that you're nervous he might stay.
A little bit, because we go through this every year. And while it's worked so far, at some point it's got to stop. I mean, some point 18, 19-year-old kids are going to say, hey, I want to know you're going to be.
Hey, my favorite rumor is Brian Kelly to Michigan. How do you feel about that?
No.
Yeah.
No, we got a guy.
Guess what? I have LSU fans in my life. I threw that rumor out there. And they were like, please, fine. They're like, go ahead. They've never been sold on him anyway. They're like, he wants it. They don't trust him. Get him out. Right? Like, I found that interesting. He could take his fake Southern accent and go back to Michigan.
I love Jim Harbaugh, but I'm ready for Sherrod. I'm ready for the guy, the number two guy, to step up and take the job.
Well, look, I will say this about my UM.
Yeah.
It's sort of do or die for Cristobal. I mean, Miami has everything went their way. And this is now the third straight top 10 recruiting class. They have the best quarterback in the portal. They've got the best offensive line, maybe second only to Michigan, but even this year, I mean, they built it. It's all there. The schedule is as easy as it can be next year. There's no Clemson on it, no North Carolina. They've got like the easy, and it's sort of like, if he doesn't win 10 or 11 games, I mean, and I felt it. I was at a couple of games this year, and, you know, they've thrown a lot of money into this program. And, like, I had one guy who made the deal with Mario, and he goes, okay, one more year, huh? And it's all like, right. Like, you know, let's just say we have very high expectations.
All right, so where can we find you talking about politics for the rest of this cycle? Where
you know, I got my podcast, the Chuck Toddcast, produced by my friends here at NBC. I write a weekly column, NBCnews.com. It's usually up most Wednesdays, unless there's a primary night where I'm up too late doing work, and then I might put it up Wednesday to Thursday. Like I'm saying that because of post-New Hampshire week. You know, and then I get to come in for the touchdowns when we're covering elections. So you'll see me there on NBC and NBC News Now.
Are you still tweeting? Do you still use Twitter a lot?
If I think I have something to add to people's knowledge about something without it being about myself, I might. I find the whole Twitter thing now just sort of a weird phenomenon. The idea that we think our opinion matters so much we have to share it. I sort of look at it. And I think a lot of journalists made a mistake of, you know, tweeting every thought bubble. And you realize if you get off of the Twitter, the thought bubbles that are worthy will stick in your head after a week, and you can write it in your column. And the ones that don't probably shouldn't have been shared in the first place.
That is a great place where to bring this to a close. Chuck Todd, you are the expert that NBC and America turns to. Can't
Thank
think
you,
it's
sir.
Going. It's very kind of you to take the time. I hope maybe I can talk you into a debrief in December. We'll have to
there
see when that time comes.
A little post-mortem. And that assumes that
we'll still be here.
Have had the Electoral College meet or not. Yeah.
Chuck, thank you very much.
All right, Adam. Good luck.
Thanks.